I have something to confess, Dan. I've been cheating on you for the last 2 weeks, and I've been recording podcasts with other people. please don't divorce me.
You know what, Alex? I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Oh no! Don't say that. We can work through this.
Okay, here is the situation. We have to be socially distant, Alex. We can't even go see a podcast counselor because we can't physically go to their office.
We could try Zoom therapy.
But how? They have a 40-minute limit now.
Oh dear, let me give you the background though, because I feel like when you know what it is, you will almost appreciate
you feel like you can make this better, do you?
I feel like I can make this slightly less salt in the wound. I said womb instead of wound, but I feel like that. Both work. So here's what happened.
Okay.
I was giving this talk the other week on a webinar, and the audience for it was like the big audience of the future consortiums here in England. Mm-hmm. So the ones that have been given like £4 million each to like, you know, work on a massive immersive project. Nice. And it got me thinking about, well, because like the timing of it was really interesting, right? Because obviously it was due to happen before all of COVID, and then all of a sudden COVID kind of rendered my presentation to them kind of a little bit useless, because although the theory might still stand, at the same time getting big immersive projects to audiences is a little bit challenging when we're all locked inside. So I was having these really interesting conversations with people like outside of the event, some of the fellow panelists like who were on the webinar, but also just like other people in industry, to get kind of like a bit of a vibe about like where everyone's at, how are people being impacted, and just generally their thoughts. Mm-hmm. You know, are people thinking, fuck this, I'm out, I'm bouncing, like this wave of VR is done, mate? Or were they thinking, actually, this is an amazing time for VR, and like everything's going to be all uphill from here? So I was having these conversations like offline, and then I was like, you know what, this would actually be really useful for people, I think, to hear these point of views. So that hence why the cheating came in, because I was like, do you know what, let me just hop on these calls that I was having anyway, and I'm just going to record them. So that's, see, it was like, it wasn't an intentional cheating. It just kind of happened, okay?
Intentional cheating is like drunk cheating, though, is it not? You were drunk cheating, Alex. Were there drugs?
Only the drug of knowledge.
Have you been on the ketamine again?
I've got a friend that has low-key called her two foster kittens cocaine and ketamine, and I think that's the most genius thing I've ever heard in my life. They're both little white little kittens, and I was like, I mean, fitting. Anyway, I'm not trying to change the subject. I think you'll agree though, as much as you are hurt by this news, as much as we have some serious relationship building to re-kind of address, I thought that it would then be interesting for us to do an episode where we talk about that, because ultimately I love chatting about this shit with you. And also I have found some interesting kind of like insights from them that I think would be quite nice to like unpack and for us to discuss, and also to get your thoughts on it. Because I just think, I don't know, you know, when you kind of like, you talk to someone and they very much kind of, that's their views, and that's kind of the whole point, right? Is just to get their views. Yeah. Whereas I wanted us to kind of go in on some of those views and just kind of, you know, attack them a little bit.
And hopefully stick to the subject.
I mean, it won't happen, yes. But we can dream.
No, it sounds like that'd be quite interesting to hear other people's takes on it, to be honest. I'm over.
So you're saying,
cheating
that
aside,
although you're bitterly disappointed in me, you're actually quite excited to hear these conversations, aren't you?
Yeah, I basically just want you to flaunt your cheating in my face. That's essentially what it is.
It's the equivalent of me cheating and then uploading the video onto a porn site. I can't look
essentially,
away.
You essentially just turned me into a cuckold.
this episode should just be called The Cut.
This is not how I imagined this episode starting.
You should have been suspicious when I was the one instigating the podcast episode.
I didn't know it was going to go into like cuck talk though. Jeez.
Always. I mean, you can just. I mean, our first episode we talked about frogs having sex. I think.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true.
Yeah, you're never safe. Yeah. So yeah. I mean, before we kick off with like some of that kind of like stuff that I've heard other people say. What's your general vibe? Like, what's the kind of vibe you've been getting off, like, the online community? How are you feeling? Because I know we kind of talked a little bit in our last episode about what both of us were feeling at that time. And like, yeah. So what are you feeling? What's your vibe? Tell me everything.
I'm very intrigued as to what a post-COVID corona world is going to look like. But in terms of VR, it's a difficult one because, again, it's still... based on sort of getting more headsets into homes, which, yeah, like given everything that's going on now, it, you know, you'd think that more people would, you know, buy a headset and give it a go. But then having said that, are they going to get hold of one now? Because there's going to be a backlog, in production. I know the Quest recently became available again, but I think it's gone again now.
Sold out within like hours or something on minutes. Amazon.
But it's a difficult one because I mean, if I'm honest, I'm not thinking about the VR industry as a whole because I'm sort of predominantly dealing 360. So I'm thinking about that and what future that has. So in terms of virtual tours and stuff like that, brilliant. I think there's still something in it for the tourism industry. Without a doubt, I think there's only so much you can recreate with computer graphics and Unity and whatnot. But I don't know. My key concern is how long is it going to take for businesses to then want to spend money on that again? Because as soon as the lockdown is over and you know things kind of, I mean, I hesitate to use the word normal, but kind of go back to whatever the new normal is. Their priorities are going to be to recoup the losses from the last, like, however long that lockdown was. So for, like, creators like us, where does that leave us from, like, a financial standpoint? Because I can't see businesses be like, oh, yeah, you know, first aid back. Yeah, let's go spend some money on this thing that, you know, may or may not work in our eyes, even though we've just lost like thousands.
Yeah. So true, isn't it? And it's funny because it's really reassuring in a weird way to hear that, because what was interesting is I think I only spoke to I did six, and I think out of those six, only two of them are creators. The rest of them are people who they might have their hand in creation, but they have a more specific role in terms of like might be distribution or networking or commercial VR or I'm trying to rack my brain for some of the others, but yeah, facilitation, like that kind of thing. So I only really spoke to two creators, and that was kind of exactly the sentiment that they shared. And it's weird because the first episode that I recorded was with Atlas 5, who are obviously a massive, well, they're not massive in terms of like size. Like I think there's only like 10 of them or something, but as a company, as a brand, they're massive in VR. They are, you know, arguably the leaders in more creative, artistic VR. And it was interesting because really they haven't been touched. And I mean, it's not surprising because they're almost, I don't know, it seems unfair to say they're too big to fail, because I don't think that's true, because they are, at the end of the day, they're still a startup. But their IP that they were working on already and the kinds of projects they're working on, you know, they're working on game-based content, animation, stuff that appeals directly to a Steam user, for example, as opposed to a new VR audience who has never experienced VR before. although I'm sure they would love to get those kind of audiences, realistically, that's not their primary audience. Basically, they have like a really sound business model. You know, they do what most businesses should be doing, which is looking for their audience and creating stuff for them. And yeah, they push the boundaries with new kind of content and they look for different ways to expand. But realistically, that is their core, which really kind of unsettled me a little bit, because I was like, I went into that call thinking, you know, having had these conversations offline, I was like, this is a shit show. Like, this is awful for our industry. We are all totally fucked. And I got onto this call, and then and Antoine, who I spoke to, was super positive. He was actually like, you know, I think that there will be more of an appetite for VR and new experiences once all of this is over. And yes, it might take 2 years. It might be, you know, not only a post-COVID world, but it might be a post-COVID vaccine world that it takes to get to that level. But people will be so sick of having had to socially distance and to, you know, stay at home and not do the things they wanted to do, that actually, you know, people will want to go out and experience new things. And I thought that was a really interesting view. And I definitely came off that call thinking, wow, okay, that's an interesting point of view, because I've not really thought about it like that. And then after speaking to other creators, I think a penny kind of dropped, and it's exactly what you've just said. And it's like, you've hit the nail on the head there.
Well, thank you.
The thing is, that might be the future. If creators and companies can weather this storm, and that's a massive if, because yes, that might happen in 2 years' time when we're all post-COVID and blah, 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 and it's all good and we've got a vaccine and we can hug each other again, great. But in between now and then, how many venues are going to go out of business? Mm-hmm. How many creators are going to have to find other jobs? How many people are going to have left this industry because of the fact that it's unsustainable? And that's the thing that makes me think this is not a clear cut thing. And I wish I had like a magic eight ball to tell us the future and to just give us a firm answer, because I'm sure you're exactly the same as me, thinking, oh, this is a really precarious position to be in, because I believe in the technology. You know, I've been doing it for a while, so I really believe in it. And, you know, same as you, you've had some amazing experiences with 360 and got to travel the world and all of this great stuff with this kind of career that we've built. But actually, you know, is this wave of 360, is this, you know, were we at its peak, and is that now coming down?
Yeah. It's funny, because like prior to this all kicking off, I was in the process of starting like a purely 360 based production company, and now I've had to tweak that.
You're like, oh shit, possibly the worst time.
Yeah, you know? I know, fucking sod's law. So I've tweaked it, so just to include just standard video production as well. But then that was a bit of a struggle, because it was like, well, the whole point was to be niche, you know, to niche down. But you know, video will survive, because you know it's video
and thrive.
It's easy for people to watch. But what I have done,
you don't require.
Yeah, but what I have done now is that I've brought a friend on board, to deal with the editing side of things. So
that's
even
great.
Even if I do go on a regular video, the editing would then go to him, and then it's on his side. So it was still, it's still predominantly kind of focused on 360. But yeah, I haven't really had much choice, because, you know, at least then I can sort of go fishing for work now, knowing that businesses will still want video in some form or other. Even if they end up shooting some footage themselves, and then it's just down to us to sort of edit it, but then at least then it's something coming in.
Well, I think that's super smart, and I think a lot of people will have to do that. And yeah, and bravo, Cook. All right, I'll stop.
I literally had a mouthful of coffee there.
No, I think that's really smart, and it's funny, because it kind of is a nice little segue onto the next kind of like little bit that just jumped out of me in my head, of like something that I spoke about with someone else, which was like more on the commercial side of VR, AR, 360, that kind of thing. And this was an interview with Jeremy Dalton, who is the head of VR and AR for PwC UK. So they're like basically one of my kind of clients. And we've done loads of projects together. But naturally, just like everyone else, they've had to like not completely change direction because they're still doing AR and VR. Actually, they were saying they're kind of more busy than ever because more people are interested in it as a solution, but it's a different kind of project. So whereas before we would do a lot of 360 work together, as I've kind of talked about on the podcast before, like training and, you know, kind of getting people familiar with different settings and that kind of vibe, like just like most 360 projects. And now they've switched to more VR for remote collaboration or VR to host virtual events. And the one thing I just wanted to bring up, which he talked about, was which I think ties in nicely with what you're saying and why you've kind of expanded to include video, is he was saying that there's no going back now. Companies will have to adopt innovation because they've realized that if suddenly the world, you know, kind of, if this happens again, which it might not take a pandemic next time, it might be the climate crisis that forces something like this again. But if this happens in future, all of those companies that had all of their revenue come from location-based activity and they had no online presence, they didn't really focus on digital marketing, they, you know, they relied on a core audience base who are now at home and they can't get to them. What they've realized is it might not necessarily right now be VR and 360, but it might be that they're like, oh shit, like, yeah, we need a video presence. We need, you know, even like TV adverts at the moment, they're all being filmed remotely. Yeah. They're all, I don't know whether you've been watching the ITV Isolation Stories, which is like a drama created by the actors at home. Okay. And don't get me wrong, it's fairly shocking. Yeah. I mean, I'm not to slate it because it's like, you know, it's a fantastic experiment. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, wow, you can watch something like that and really appreciate good cinematography. Mm-hmm. And then you go, wow, yeah, like the difference between something that is well lit and well shot, and even if the dialogue and the acting is good, like there's so much that cinematic look kind of adds to it. But anyway, I feel like people are going to appreciate that more than ever because people will realize there's no going back now. Like, we live in an online world and it's not quite a virtual world yet. It's not quite the kind of, you know, the oasis, but there is something to be said for companies that are going to need that online presence. And so being in the kind of the general digital space, whether that be video, audio, or, you know, or 360 and VR, that's going to be huge for people going forward, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I haven't seen that drama series, but like you say, there's a lot of ads now that have, you know, comprised of, like, have you seen the co-op ad, where it's just people that have like filmed themselves, give like saying a line and stuff, and they've just shot it on their own phone and it's been edited together. But it actually works.
Oh,
well.
Is it the one where they sing the song? Or is it, are they just saying
something? No, they're just saying something. They're like, oh, you know, despite everything that's going on, we can all stick together and all this. I mean, like they're moaning. I haven't really done it justice.
I guess.
It's very more. It's much more heartfelt than I did it. But despite the fact it's just like all these various like co-op employees from across the country, and they've obviously shot it on their phones and stuff. No, you know, audio gear or whatever, anything like that. But it actually works quite well, and it would work. It would still work quite well. For me personally, anyway, even if we wasn't going through all this, so I don't know. Yeah. It just kind of goes to show that, you know, you can create these impactful commercials and stuff without all the big expensive gear, which is handy for me because I don't own any of that. So I'm looking at it and thinking,
well,
bingo.
I've always been very, very tempted. Like you say, the niche thing is interesting because, like you say, my niche is the same as yours, or has been, like with the VR and 360 industry. But I've always thought there would be an amazing business in iPhone only shoots. So I do like a lot of if I'm like shooting like a normal video for like a friend's music video, or just like a general little like interview thing or a mini doc like that I do for some of my friends. Like, I will literally only use my iPhone, and they don't come out half bad. Yeah, yeah. And I think there's going to be something in that. I'm not sure. The only problem with that, and it's interesting, it's the perceived value, isn't it? It's like, the first time I did a 360 shoot, I remember I rocked up with the Kodak Pix Pro, which is the it's one of the first 360 shoots, but and it's like those, just like the two block cameras back to back, and it's tiny, obviously. And I remember the client kind of like looking at it and going,
"Is that it?
Is that it?" Yeah. And so from then on, even if it sounds terrible, but even if the 1X is good enough to give you a picture that would be good enough for a project. Yeah, we would probably hire, you know, a pro or a Titan and have like three crew members manning it, because actually so much of it is about the perception of it if you're charging a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I wish it wasn't like that, but that's the truth, isn't it?
Yeah. I used to get on some of my corporate shoots and stuff as well. I'd like rock up with like a little Sony A6300 and stuff, and they'd be like, "Oh, is that it? You're like, what are you expecting, mate? Like a big BBC camera or something?"
Which is ironic, right? Because your Sony probably like shot better than like some of the old, if you rocked it with like a massive old school broadcast camera, the quality of your Sony would be a million times better.
It's like, I could have brought one. Like, I have like an old like Canon video camera from the 80s. I guess I could have.
The retro video camera. That. Like,
can use the big camera if you want, mate, but it only shoots on video.
Do you want to distribute a VHS? The only thing harder than distributing in VR.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I think I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see where this all leads, right? And the creators that I did speak to on the kind of the aforementioned cheating, they seemed, you know, I feel like they were a balanced of like positive and negative. Like, negative in the sense of, yes, my livelihood has just been wiped off the face of the earth. Yes, I've like, you know, I don't feel optimistic in terms of, you know, how quickly I'm going to bounce back from this. But positive in the sense of, I still believe that the technology is there, and actually all we need to do is we need to work out how we get kind of through to the consumer. Oh, interesting, actually. Sorry, I've just had two coffees this morning, and so it's just going to be a ramble on, right? I just read before we jumped on that Magic Leap, you know how they laid off half their employees last month? I just read this morning that apparently they've got until June to be bought or find new investment. Yeah. Otherwise, they'll have to like, you know, stop. Yeah. They'll have to go bankrupt or whatever. And I'm like, that is interesting, because fundamentally what they were selling was like, the idea of what they were selling was really cool, but the product was just shit. And like, no one's paying $2,000 for that thing. You know, a consumer is not paying that much money, and it seemed odd that that's, you know, that they didn't kind of recognize that sooner, weirdly, with all that investment. But this draws back to something that Jeremy said as well, was this idea of like, he's kind of put it down to like four reasons why a consumer would not buy a headset, whether it be VR or MR. And that is cost, content, user experience, and I can't remember what the last one was. I think it was like exposure to it or something. And I'm gonna have to go back and listen. But cost, obviously, like the cost is too high for what it is right now. The content, obviously, the content's not there. Like, it's not good enough for everyone. There's not enough AAA kind of content yet. User experience being the big one, because everyone knows how to use like a smartphone. Yeah. And even if you're an iPhone user and you jump on an Android, yes, it's alien, but it's kind of the same. Like, you can apply the same principles, whereas that's not the case in VR. It's really hard. It's like a hard learning curve. Even if you know VR, like, even if you've been in a VR headset hundreds of times, sometimes you get on a new app and it's still a little bit like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And then that last one, exposure, that idea of like, you can't explain to someone what it means to have an immersive experience. You can't explain to someone what VR is. You can't live stream. Like, I watched one of the social VR live streams the other day, and I was like, because I didn't have access to my Quest at the time, and I was like, you know, yeah, it's not the same. It's like you're watching a flat rectangular version of something and you're not getting the benefit of being there. So again, that kind of, that exposure to that first time VR experience, which at the moment is impossible because you can't get a headset because they're sold out. You can't go to a venue and see any VR because they're all closed, and you can't even go to a friend's house to try it for the first time. So he sees those as like the four barriers, which I thought was interesting because I've never heard it been like, it makes sense, but I've never heard it be defined like that before. Yeah. And that makes me think, wow, like how long is it going to be until this thing is, you know, is it going to be like Gary Vaynerchuk predicts, which is like 20, 30 years before this stuff is like anywhere close to being mainstream?
Yeah, it's a weird one. I think as well, I think in, and especially like this is really like specifically in terms of 360, I think, excuse me, I think a lot of content is viewed when people are just, you know, going through their news feeds and stuff on like your Facebook or whatever and stuff, and a video pops up. Yeah. If it's, you know, especially on Facebook, because obviously they have that the 360 capability on there. If you're just on your phone and you're scrolling along, nobody's going to be like, oh, that looks interesting, and then go and dig out the headset and then put the headset on, then go find that video again, even if they've like bookmarked it or whatever, if you can do that, I don't know. And then watch it, because there's a faff. It's not, it's not instant.
Yeah, it's not seamless.
And, you know, especially in like the age that we live in, where, you know, people's time is valuable, although maybe not so much right now. it's, yeah, there's that, that hurdle in between, which I very think true. Doesn't really help. But very quickly, going back to the whole Magic Leap thing, this is something I don't understand about the companies that get funding, like millions and millions in funding. And then something like this comes along and they're like, oh no, going to have to close down. You've just been given like 50 odd million.
2.6 billion.
Yeah.
Billion.
Oh, yeah, well, there you go then. There you go. That's, it makes it even worse. What have you done with that? Why have you just completely thrown all that away? That's mental.
Yep.
You could have made that last years. I don't get it. I don't get it.
This is like, have you ever watched Silicon Valley? Like the TV show? It's basically, it's funny because when I was on an accelerator a couple of years ago, and the funny thing about that TV show, that's exactly what it's like. Like the investment world is so fucked up. I have no idea. I just feel like it takes a special kind of asshole to like to make that work and have that, like you say, that kind of conscience. Like it's a bit like the WeWork scenario, right? Where like, you know, that was worth however many billion, well, supposedly valued at billions, and then when they went to IPO on the stock market, they like basically something like 3/4 of the value was wiped off. And instead of like, you know, imagine if like you've had investors, that's their money, that's their livelihoods, like, and yes, they're usually high net worth individuals, so to them maybe, you know, 500 grand is like the equivalent of a tenner to us maybe, but still, that's someone's money. Someone had to work hard for that money, and you've just gone and like lost it. But that is the truth about the investment world, is that's the whole point. And the idea of invested companies is realistically, the idea is that they don't make profit for at least 5 to 10 years. And then the idea is that they exit. So they either get bought or they go public or they become profitable, but very few of them actually become profitable. Like you look at Spotify, I think they've only just recently, I don't know whether they actually went, they became profitable, or they just got loads of new subscribers, which put them like borderline profitable. But the idea of a Spotify, for example, is not to be profitable. It's to have mass penetration, which basically means like, you know, a bit like Netflix. If they can get half the world to be on Spotify, then they become the most valuable asset in the world, because it's not really about you know, getting people to pay for a subscription to music. Mm. It's about having access to half the world's data and half the world's attention, which you can then sell to other companies. Mm. And that's like, that's basically the whole game of investment. And I remember when we were, we got to the end of the accelerator, we were pitching to VCs and angel investors. And we started like a fair few conversations, and it was looking really promising. Like people were really quite, this was when I was, me and my brother were creating like a software that was a tool to create interactive experiences like in VR. It was mainly aimed at the training market, subconscious VR for anyone, for only the OGs that remember me talking about it, and then conveniently just never mention it again. Well, and that was because, and I don't know whether I've ever said this publicly, well, that was because, well, A, at the time where we were about to kind of like, you know, start a fundraise, as they say, and we were going after 250 grand, so quarter of a million, based on the premise that we would, you know, potentially have clients with, or like, you know, we would have enough people paying for it to seem viable within like 3 years. So someone was going to give us quarter of a million pounds, because maybe in 3 years' time, we might have loads of people using it. And I remember at the time, my brother was just about to have his first baby. And, well, he personally wasn't, obviously. he was about to become a dad. And the reality of having a company like that is that you basically handcuff yourself to the company and to the people that have invested in you for 10 years. That's kind of the deal when you're a startup. And we had that conversation where it was like, we could go all in on this, but A, is it the right time because you're about to become a dad? And B, do I want to be, because I would be like the leader of this thing. I would be like essentially the CEO of this company. Like, do I want to give up everything else that I'm doing and just go all in on this startup? And the truth was, I was like, I wasn't willing to do it, because I wasn't willing to handcuff myself for 10 years. And also, I didn't want like the responsibility of like, it's fine if I lose my own money, it's my money. Yeah. but like losing someone else's money, imagine. And I remember meeting up with one of the other people on that accelerator. He was one of the only ones that actually did raise like quite a massive amount of investment. And I remember catching up with him, must be like maybe earlier this year or like late last year. And his burn rate, aka the amount of money that they spend as a company per week, was £80,000. So he'd grown from this tiny little company on this accelerator program to a company that spent 80 grand a week.
But on what though?
On staff, on marketing, on going to events, on legal teams, on opening a New York office so he could have a global presence.
So on all this like, stuff that just, isn't just, absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what I don't understand. Like, I don't, they must get this money, especially like something like Magic Leap. So you got 2.5 billion and they're like, right, there we're going to get all, we're going to get the best offices, the biggest offices. Don't need it, mate. Yeah. We're going to have the best coffee. Don't need it. Don't need it. It's not necessary, mate. Not necessary. Just have instant coffee. It's fine. Oh, we're going to have a,
don't get fancy.
We're going to have a ball pit with a slide in the office. Maybe. All right. Maybe I can see. I can see where your head's at. That would be good, but we'll leave that for now.
No, I'll have it. Coffee as long as I can get my
book. Yeah. But it's not absolutely necessary. Just need like a small space, just the only amount of people. No, I'm gonna have a personal assistant. Don't need it. Don't need him.
Yeah.
Her. Whoever. Don't need him. Just spend the money that you absolutely need to spend. Have a small space just to get the staff that you absolutely need. Don't have these other like randoms that are just there to stroke your ego and whatnot.
Yep.
God, I'm ranting. I'm ranting.
It's so true. No, but exactly.
It's that's mental. The point there, right? Absolutely mental. Yeah. And I don't get it. And then it comes to things like this. And they're like, and like you say about Magic Leap, potentially going bust. You had 2.5 billion. Yep. What have you done with it?
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. We need a private jet just for us. No, you don't. No, you don't. There's plenty of other airlines that you could fly.
The joke is that it's like you say, it's all about the image and it's all about that mass market appeal. It's all about the fact that if you want to be a company that rubs shoulders with the likes of Apple and Facebook, and like if you want to be in the big kid playground, you have to look the part. And not only do you have to look the part, you have to have what all the other big kids have. So you can't be a solopreneur, you know, earning probably, you know, yes, this is the thing that really like makes me die on the inside when people are like, oh my God, all these, you know, million billionaires, whatever. They're not. That's the joke. Like, I don't know whether anyone listening or you, Dan, have like watched any interviews with Tom Bilyeu, who runs Impact Theory. But he was the founder of Quest Bars, which is like the protein kind of company, which is like worth billions, right? But before him and his wife started Quest, they were part of this other company, right? And it was a startup, and it was valued. I think he said it was valued at like 4 billion at its peak, right? So he had 25% share in a company that was worth 4 billion. So therefore, people were like, well, he's a billionaire. And that's what they say about Zuckerberg. He's a billionaire. But they're not really billionaires. They have an asset that is worth a billion if they were to sell it. But what happened with Tom is, I think it was something like I can't remember what the business was. I think it was similar in the health space. Overnight, one of their biggest competitors came out with a product that was very similar to theirs. And overnight, their company was worth nothing. So literally within 24 hours, he went from being worth $1 billion because he owned 25% of a company worth $4 billion to being worth nothing. And the reality of those kind of startups is that you don't pay yourself that much money. So like I was saying, the guy on the accelerator program with me, who now has a burn rate of 80 grand a year, he probably pays himself he wouldn't pay himself like shit money, but he wouldn't be paying himself what people would think he'd be paying himself. He'd be paying himself maybe like 50, 60 grand, and he would be putting all the other money into the company, right? So it's not like they'd be earning like, you know, a decent salary once they get to a certain size. But the reality when you first start a startup is that you're bootlegging, you are working for shit money because all of your value is in these companies. So like you say, that with the Magic Leap thing, like the founders of that, I mean, don't get me wrong, they've probably found ways to siphon off millions because, you know, if you've earned that much money, like, why wouldn't you? If you've like raised that much money. But the reality is, yes, they've like essentially like just blown this $2.6 billion.
That's mental.
Like when realistically, they like, because this is the thing I've been thinking about a lot recently, and I'm sure it's the same for you, is when you start to think about what you're going to do for work, you start to think about what lifestyle you want. Mm-hmm. And actually the lifestyle is more important than what you're doing. Like, you know, it's kind of, you want to love what you do, but you also want to be able to, the job is not what defines you. It's not what defines your life. You want to be able to do something that you love to do as a result of the work you do. So actually creating a massive business with loads of employees where you have to work 13, 14 hours a day because there's just so much to do, and there's staff that you have to pay their wages, and you're accountable for them. Like you're paying for these people's rent and their families, and it all depends on you. Like, that is way more stress like, for example, you and I would maybe want. I want enough money so I can go on like a good few holidays and have the freedom that I want. That's more important than money. Definitely.
But if someone had given me like $2.5 billion funding and stuff, I wouldn't be concerned about the image. If you flip it, who's going to stand out more? The person that has been given that funding but doesn't, you know, is not bothered about the lifestyle and stuff, is low key. Is that not going to cause, like, create more noise around them? Because they're like, well, hang on a minute, he's not flaunting it like everyone else is. What's up with that?
Yeah, probably. But then that's like, because it's not 2.6 billion, like, here you go, here's a check for this company that doesn't exist, 2.6 billion. It's like, he would have, I think it's a he who started it. I could be very sexist, but I'm fairly certain it was a guy in Silicon Valley. And I think what happened was it was him and a very small team of devs. And then they would have raised maybe what, like yeah, a few million, tens of millions, maybe, on the premise of we've got this prototype that we've been hustling away at. We've invested our own money into it. We really believe in it. This is the vision for the company. Some VCs would have then been like, oh, yeah, I really believe in you, the person who leads this thing. And I really believe in the product and the vision you have for it. But in order to create the vision that you want, like, say, for example, if I was like, look, I'm going to take the Oculus Quest, I'm going to take what it is now, and I'm going to make it the size of a contact lens. Mm-hmm. Like, believe in my vision. That's the only way that the consumer is gonna use VR, is if it's a contact lens or a glass, right? So, okay, so this is my vision for the company. I believe I have the technology to do it, but it's gonna take 10 years to get there, and it's gonna require manufacturers, a shit ton of devs. I need a research team to look at, like, you know, all the different ways that we could minimize it. We need, you know, a chip developer like Intel to, like, provide something that's super small that it could fit in a glass, but it's is cheap enough for not to make the product too expensive. And so all of a sudden you've got this roadmap. And so maybe, like, every 2 years you would go back to investors and say, look, we've made progress. We've got a much bigger team working on this. We've made, like, we're showing really good signs. And your job as the CEO is to convince them to still believe in the dream, because we're nowhere near the dream, but still believe in the dream. It's going to happen, I promise. So then they go, okay, well, fine. You can have another 50 million. You can have another 100 million. You can have another 200 million. And what's happened with Magic Leap is they've gotten to the point where it took them 10 years to release, I think it took them 8 years to release their first actual, you know, sellable product, which was in 2018. And that was basically, that whole 8 years was where they raised all of that billions worth of investment to get to the point where they could release something. And then what's happened with them is they've released this product that they've been talking about for 8 years, that all of these investors have believed in this vision, in this idea. And it's just completely flopped, because no one wants to look like Willy Wonka. No one wants mixed reality right now. It doesn't do what it promised to do, which is, you know, you see the cool, like, holographic stuff in schools and stuff. It's yeah. And so it doesn't do what it's, and this is exactly what happened with that really famous case, Theranos. I don't know whether do you know about that? Yeah. It's the same thing. Like, Elizabeth Holmes had this vision. She convinced people that it was possible. And the truth is, no matter how much money she had, it wasn't possible. It, right now, with the technology that they had, it wasn't possible. And obviously, that's kind of way worse, because she was dealing with people's health and was, like, lying about it, which is why she's obviously now in prison or going to be charged or something like that,
doing,
whatever's happening.
The voice as well. Forget the voice. Yeah. Did you not see that she put on, like, a deeper voice as well?
Oh, yeah, of course.
But people take her seriously. Like, hello, hello. Nobody's taking you seriously with that voice, mate.
Well, exactly. And that's, like, the weird, that's the thing that is, like, so insidious about Silicon Valley and, like, the investment world, is it's all about image. Mm. And then when you can't deliver on that image, that's when you have, like, a Magic Leap situation. But the only people that lose out on that Magic Leap situation is the whole industry, because someone's overpromised and it's, like, killed any kind of confidence. Investors won't go near stuff necessarily as quickly because of, like, such a huge fuck up. You know, there's all of this stuff that has, like, this adverse effect, but the founders of Magic Leap, they'll be fucking fine. Like, realistically, Magic Leap will probably, at the very worst, sell all of its tech and all of its research and all of its IP and patents, at the very worst, and that'll be for millions. And so the founders are going to be absolutely fine, but it's the repercussions of that is the really annoying thing. I think we should go out and raise some money. What do you reckon? I reckon I can convince someone that we could do some good shit.
I'm game. And I would make sure we just spend it appropriately as well.
Stay humble.
Yeah.
Oh, but I want the private jet.
Tough. You're gonna sit in a shed with some instant coffee.
Like a Keep true visionary. Yeah.
So how are you prepping for post COVID, post coronavirus?
I'm not really.
Wow.
I probably should be, but
just enjoying the downtime.
Yeah, I feel like I am really enjoying the downtime, actually. And there's, like, that niggling voice in my head saying, you should be doing shit, you should be being productive. But I've done like bits and bobs. Like I did like a little creative challenge just to kind of get myself like back in the rhythm of stuff, and then realize that what's the point in spending loads of time on creative projects when not necessarily creative projects, but what's the point in doing creative outlets when A, I'm not really enjoying it because I'm not really in a creative mood at the moment, and B, I already know the creative project that I want to make when I'm out of this, and it's already, you know, it's already funded. Like I've just got to wait for this lift so that we can actually shoot it. So so I think the stuff that I've been prepping really is more around like what I want to do going forward, because I know that I definitely want to make Bad News still, and I'm excited to do that. I think it's going to be really interesting. I do think about, you know, am I going to have to change it slightly? And am I going to have to make a version that is more accessible? Because at the end of the day, we might not be able to show it in independent venues, which was like the original distribution plan. So I am thinking about, well, yeah, like, so, because obviously it's BFI funded, and then the idea would be then to then show it in independent cinemas. But realistically, unless it kind of takes, I mean, it could, to be fair, it could take that long to actually be able to create it. But what does that world look like in 2 years' time when we might be able to show it? And will the content still be relevant? I'm not sure. So I'm just using this time to kind of, yeah, have a think about what I want to do next. I think like you, I'm definitely going to diversify out of just being a 360 and VR creator director. Like I'm not sure what that looks like yet. I'm kind of musing on that, but that's kind of what I'm up to. What about you?
Excuse me. For the record, I don't have it, and I'm just clearing my throat.
Are you digitally transmitting the virus to me? How dare you?
Just seeing if that works. just like I said, you know, starting this production company, but having to diversify it a bit. But then having said that, I think in some ways this is, it's may be beneficial to me because I quite like that I have someone else involved with it, because I've worked on my own for like so long. It's now quite nice that I have someone that has like a sounding board for ideas and stuff.
Really cool.
And someone that can take on like a portion of work. So if I get to a point where I'm like getting a bit fed up of, you know, making the same stuff over and over again like I was before, at least then I'm only working on one aspect of it. So I'm not seeing the whole thing through from start to finish, as it were.
So are you focusing on like the filming and the ideas and that kind
of thing? So, but any 360 stuff, I will work on solely myself. Unless he's gets to a point, because he hasn't edited 360 before. And then I'm very particular about it anyway. So I'd keep that stuff to myself, but yeah, just general video and stuff that he'd be in charge of all the editing and post-production side of things, which is quite nice. And then I could just focus on the filming. And then also that allows me to sort of potentially bring in double the workload, because I'm not spending half the time editing myself. Someone else is doing it. So that allows me to, you know, if there's a couple of days where I would be editing, that's a couple of days where I could be out working on a different project.
And how are you going about getting the work?
Well, we haven't yet. We haven't officially launched it as yet. So I'm still sorting out the website at the moment. But there's going to be a social aspect to it. So we're going to have like a little kind of company mascot that we're going to hide in our work. And then, so whenever that bit of work gets launched, well, I don't know. I'm not sure how I'm going to do it in 360 yet, because obviously in a headset, it's going to be difficult to spot. So it's going to have to be quite large.
I like that though. I think that's funny. I think it's funny in a 360 piece.
The idea is
Easter egg.
The idea is to kind of make each project quite social. So whenever something, like, say a video launches, the day it launches, obviously we will advertise it online and say, look, if you spot the mascot in the video, drop us an email, this particular email address, and then we'll pick a name out of a hat, and then you'll get like a free goodie bag with some like merch or something in it.
Nice.
So yeah, it just makes it a little bit more interactive.
So you're doing the merch. You're going to put together a merch bag.
Yeah. So, but really, it would essentially just be funded. I mean, it wouldn't cost major amounts because I looked into it, but that would essentially, you know, come out of the what would be charged for the product for the project. But really, what it would do is it would also lead people to watch, I don't know, like a promo for something that they wouldn't necessarily watch anyway. Yeah. And then the theory is that if they're watching it over and over again to try and spot it, then that product or whatever it is going to subconsciously stay in there, in the back of their mind.
Yeah, watching it more. I mean, it's good, a really good idea. The holy grail of digital marketing is that replayability, yeah. Right? So that makes total sense.
It all just stems from oh dear.
You really have got coronavirus.
I may.
I hope you're okay. I might have to check.
There
up
may
on
not
you.
Be a next episode. Oh my God. You could carry on cheating on me.
It was the comments. Yeah, it just pushed you over the edge.
No, the idea is kind of stemmed from my kind of geeky love of Easter eggs in like movies and stuff.
Yeah.
I always found that fascinating. And that was like from ages ago. I think I touched on it in a previous episode where I used to watch all of the director's commentaries on DVDs and stuff. And I'd always find it fascinating where they'd, you know, hide something within a scene that either meant something to them or was like an homage to something and stuff. Mm. And I always found that really cool. So I think it would just be a cool way to have some sort of like, you know, character or mascot or something, and then just have that in each bit of work that's done through the company.
So good. Such a good idea. And then eventually that icon becomes so iconic that that becomes the IP that you're known for, which means that then you franchise that. That's how it all works, right? The money's in the action figures, as is it Lucas says that? George Lucas?
That. Yeah. And he knows everything.
Such a genius. So true. Oh, I know this is like harking back to, I think we talked about this on the podcast. Or maybe this was just like an offline conversation we were having, but you were saying that you went to see Jay and Silent Bob reboot, and Kevin Smith was there doing an interview. Me and my dad, it just came to mind because you said about like Easter eggs, and me and my dad watched it the other month, and it was so good. Like, I loved it. I loved like how that was like the classic thing of, if you're a Kevin Smith fan, it's such a joy to watch a film like that, because even though like, you know, it is what it is at the end of the day, it's a Kevin Smith film, but at the end of the day, there's so many amazing references to all the other kind of IPs in it. And that in turn made me want to, again, it's that whole replayability thing. It made me want to watch it again because I was like, what have I missed? And then I went online and I was looking at, you know, reviews of it, and I wanted to watch interviews with Kevin to like hear about the process and how, you know, how he got all of his old big celeb buddies in it and all of the Easter eggs that I missed and that kind of thing. And it's the buy-in to the universe that makes all the cash.
That's one of the things he said. He his films don't make money, and they never have. But his income streams just essentially just are from him just like speaking. So obviously he did a lot of events and like sort of one-man shows and stuff. Are you subscribed to his YouTube channel?
I don't think so.
You should check it out. So I mean, at the moment it's a lot of him just chatting away about, you know, projects and his career and stuff. But I've always said like he's an absolute joy to watch for me, because he's very down to earth, and he's very humble. Yeah. Like he knows that his films aren't great, and he's, you know, he's never going to be an award winning filmmaker and stuff, but he you know, he just feels lucky that, you know, he makes stuff that he would like to watch and that he enjoys, and that has an audience. You know, it's a niche audience, but it's an audience nonetheless. And he always says that he's like been lucky to, like, he feels lucky to have made a living out of that. But then he also, when he sold Clerks, he bought a comic shop with some of the money that he got from it.
Did he?
Yeah. So one of the things he was talking about on one of the recent ones when this all kicked off was what's going to happen with the comic shop. He's like, because he was debating whether or not, you know, that would still exist when all this blows over. It's quite interesting. And then he'll go through things that people have been.
What's his views on it?
He was saying it was like a whole story. So basically, he bought it for his friend to run, because his friend had always said that would be his dream job, to run a comic book shop. So when the Clerks money came in, he mentioned it to his friend, and his friend was like, I don't want to do that. And then it kind of just, did a complete 180. And then after a little while, he's like, oh, no, actually, it would be pretty cool. So then he bought it. So when all this kicked off, Kevin was kind of like, oh, I don't know, man. You know, do we cut our losses? Because it's going to be quite difficult. And this guy was like, no, because it's not. Like just a business. This is like, it's a place where people also go to hang out, and you know, there's like a family vibe to it. You know, it's become more than a business now. So it's like, you can't.
That's
really it,
and that's the holy grail, right? That's what people need, and in terms of like surviving in a world where increasingly we are spending more and more time in the digital world. The thing that you have to offer in a location based experience or like a retail experience is the fact that it's not just about buying something. It's about the community around it. It's about like the extra value that you're adding, and any retail location based business that hasn't clocked onto that is going to be, they will have really suffered through this time, and there might not be an audience for them to come back to, because we're all used to now buying stuff online and getting it delivered and not going out as much and not shopping as much. And what we will be craving when we come out of this thing is those social interactions that actually mean something. So I imagine that for all the comic nerds out there, it's going to be a glorious day to like rock up to that comic shop and be like, you know, what have you been up to for the last 2 months? Or, you know what I mean? Like reignite that social interaction. So that makes total sense.
It's funny because it was like a similar thing when I was a kid. I was really into like the Warhammer and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I remember Warhammer. Yeah.
But I wasn't so much into playing it, because it was just far too advanced for me. It wasn't a case of just, you know, you have to move so many centimeters and stuff if you get this, and you have to measure it all out so you get the distance right and all this. And it was just, I don't know, there was too much going on. I couldn't be bothered with it. But I enjoyed painting the figures, and I would go to the Games Workshop stores and go sit there, buy some figures, and then sit down and paint them. And you just get chatting to other people and stuff. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and then watch people play the games.
Yeah, I used to have the same thing. I used to have the same thing with Forbidden Planet. My parents would like love like cool TV shows or slightly off mainstream TV shows, and same with me. And I remember we used to, every single like weekend we would go into town and we'd go to Forbidden Planet, and there might be like a signing that day from like an actor from one of our like shows, or there might be just like, so yeah, there'd always be something going on, and you would be able to connect with these other people that had this quite niche interest. It's interesting though, because I look back at that and it's thinking, yeah, like I was probably one of the only kids in my school that really liked something like Xena the Warrior Princess or Dragon Ball Z or something, even though Dragon Ball Z was a bit more popular because it was on Cartoon Network, but yeah, I don't really remember connecting with everyone at school, you'd go to Forbidden Planet and all of a sudden, like, you'd see like a kid similar age, like buying something, and you'd be like, yeah, chatting about it, be like, oh, I've already got that one. Like, you know, oh, this special edition or whatever. And yeah, it was like definitely about that creating community.
I used to work office next door to Forbidden Planet, and I was literally in there every lunch break. Spent so much money in there. It was ridiculous.
Oh, that's so good. I have a funny story about Forbidden Planet, because my last TV gig that I had, I was a development producer, and what we were doing was we were like pitching a lot of like factual based shows, which kind of like fly on the wall documentary style. And one of them that I think I pitched it, and then it ended up getting like, let's make a taster around it, was all about like a fly on the wall in the Forbidden Planet store in London, like the big one. And so I got to like go and like film like this little taster and like talk to the people that like ran it, and like people you know, that would do signings and stuff like that there. And it was really, I would have totally watched that show. It was a bit too niche at that time, because we hadn't branched out into this big online series world yet, because I think there would still, like, to this day, I think there would be a massive audience for that now. But yeah, back then it wasn't quite, but I just remember living my absolute like 13-year-old dream, like doing that taster.
There's like, there's a few places that have like that same sort of audience. So I don't know if do you know of the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square? Or just off Leicester Square? So that's essentially like a small little independent cinema, like for film fans by film fans. So it's my favorite cinema in the entire world. So they don't usually, they don't show films on their first run. They'll usually sort of show it, I don't know, a month after it's come out or something, depending on the film anyway. But they'll have it's a very niche thing. So they'll have nights that are like sing along Sound of Music. So everyone would go down there, a lot of people would dress up and stuff, and you just sing along. They have the show Labyrinth. You've seen it, Labyrinth?
Yeah, they do
that, and they have like a masquerade ball on Labyrinth night.
That's so cool. So it was all about these like community like type events.
And it's you're always guaranteed to have a good time, because it's such a good audience. And not only that, but you don't have to worry about people talking in there and stuff, because everyone there is like a film fan and respects it. Like, even if the film isn't that good, they respect, you know, that work has gone into that film. And then over Halloween and Christmas, they'll do like marathons where they just show like films throughout the night, and then you leave like the following morning. So me and my friend did one a couple of years back for Halloween. We did one. It started at 9 o'clock at night, and then he didn't leave till about, I think it finished about 7:30 the following morning.
Oh my god! Would people sleep like in their cinema chairs?
No. Some people left earlier, but what a lot of people do is that they'll get their seats, then they'll go downstairs and get changed into pajamas. So it's just like a slumber party in a cinema.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's really good. And that's the place where they show, do you know The Room? The film?
The Room.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
Oh, Alex, don't.
It's not a recent film.
No. No, it's not.
No, I haven't seen it then.
Well, have you not heard of it?
The Room?
Yeah.
Don't think so.
Oh, Alex, you're killing me. Oh, you're tearing me apart, Alex. Those who know will get that reference.
This is the one that the disaster artist is based on. Yeah, I have heard of it.
So they have monthly screenings of it there. And that is hands down the best cinema experience I've ever had. going to see that.
Wow.
Because the film, yeah, the film is awful. It is absolutely terrible. But as an experience, it's just incredible. Just being in a room full of people, just ripping the film apart, is just a joy. And it's really difficult to describe to other people, but I have, whenever I like, introduce someone new to it, I always make a point of like letting them know beforehand that I do tend to, like, in throughout the whole runtime of the film, I kind of black out a bit and I'm just shouting stuff constantly, but I don't realize I'm doing it. I just go into autopilot.
You're like taken over. Yeah,
so like
by
so
a
people
demon.
Who know me well but have never you know that I'm like sort of fairly quiet and I'm not much of a shouter, but in there I'm someone completely different. So they're like, I've never seen that side of you before. And I was like, yeah, I'm sorry about it.
I love that. Well, it's funny because not to want to bring this slightly back on track before we wrap up, because you know that's not what this podcast is about. But I feel like what you've just said there is really, really important for us to kind of remember in the immersive industry, because what you just said there is that realistically the experience of like watching the film is not really the experience that you're bought into. Yeah. The experience that you're bought into is having such a like a communal, hilarious, like bonding experience with these people in this venue that was specifically created for people to come together and share this passion that they have. And yes, like there's so much out there about VR getting hate for not being social. Yeah. But to some extent, I mean, you kind of have to agree, right? Because like you say, like the reason you go to a cinema nowadays is not to watch a film, because you can watch a film at home. It once upon a time was, but it's not anymore. The reason you go to a cinema now is to have an experience, to have that communal experience. I remember the last, I saw Shape of Water last probably in a cinema, but oh no, hang on. No, I watched something more recent than that, but I can't remember what it was. But the last time I went to a cinema and had like one of those experiences was around Booksmart.
Okay,
and yeah. Booksmart, full disclosure, I was 100% ready to get that, like, you know, kind of back alley link, you know, not wait for it to come on a VOD service, just like find it on Putlocker or something like that, like, and just watch it. And then I saw this tweet from Olivia Wilde, because obviously it was her directorial debut, and she was like, especially if you were a woman considering watching this film, please, please, please go to a cinema, because you know, you vote with your money, you vote with your attention, and we want to show studios that these kind of stories, these female-led, funny, you know, super bad-like films can be for girls too. And so I was like, all right, Olivia Wilde, fine. Like, I'll gather up a few of my mates and we'll go to the cinema and watch it. And it was hands down one of the best cinema experiences I've ever had, because there were so many like laugh out loud moments. And if you'd watched it at home, it definitely wouldn't have been as funny on your own. But because you're like sat there in this, like, admittedly, it was majoritively like women in this cinema, and I was with my mates, and it was like there were so many laugh out loud moments, and you were just having this, this really authentic, like, communal experience. You felt bonded, like, in that. And we were all there because we wanted to support, you know, this woman who had basically cried out and said, make sure that you go and do this, make sure that you, like, you vote with your pound. And now, don't get me wrong, I'm the first to be like, do you know what, that model is dead, it's dying, like, we can't do anything about it, eventually it will die. And yes, what that means is the independent stuff gets cut first because it doesn't make any money, and that's really sad. But there's this whole new world for independent filmmakers, you know, with the kind of the streaming services, and it doesn't have to be a $100 million movie that gets made and shown at a cinema. Like, we don't need those films anymore necessarily. You can make those, well, you can carry on making those films, but like, accept that audiences want to be able to see at home. But when you do go to a cinema for experience, when you do go, it's not because you want to see the film, it's because you want to have that communal experience. And I think that's so important for us to think about and try and translate over.
I don't know, I'm the opposite. If I'm going to see a film normally, I I will try and go at a time when I don't think there's going to be anyone else in there. Because
that's the most hermit thing I've ever heard. It's great.
It is, though, because I think other people ruin it. If I'm going to watch a film, I know there's probably going to be at least one person there that's going to annoy me.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to spend a lot of the film, not really concentrating on the film, but just stewing and just biting my tongue until I get to the point when I just flip. And then I'm having to have a pop at someone because they keep checking their phone or whatever. And then all I can see is the light from their phone. Mate, if you need to check your phone, don't fucking come cinema. If it's that urgent, don't fucking come here. Simple as that.
Well, I think the difference is that you're... can you hear me all right, by the way? Because my head...
You sound a bit more distant.
Yeah, it's because my headphones...
Oh, there we go. You're back.
Okay. I guess the thing that I would say, though, is like... That's because you're a cinephile and like you're not the kind of person that would want to watch a film at home on Netflix, but you're like a hardcore cinephile.
Yeah. So I think it depends. It depends on the film. Like, I wouldn't want to watch Avengers Endgame for the first time at home.
Yeah.
Like that's a big screen, like Dolby surround sound movie for me, you know, and maybe that's one of the shared, like, moments. I, you know, have a little cry with everyone else during a particular scene. I won't spoil it just in case there's the odd few people that still haven't seen it. But
yeah, I haven't seen it.
So. There you go, see? Present company. I wouldn't want to see that, something like that, just premiere on Netflix.
Yeah, that's
unless I lived in a cinema. And then I could look out, then I'm like, oh, it's not so bad. And then that would be perfect as well. That'd be my dream home, because then I'd have it to myself.
So the ideal is to have the cinema experience but alone in the comfort of your own house.
That would be the dream.
All we need is just for Immersive to really pop off, so we can get our investment, we can become the next Magic Leap, get our billions, but just have a shed in the back garden and spend all the money on an in-home cinema experience.
Have you ever tried big screen in VR?
Is that an app?
Yeah.
No. Is it similar to like Netflix though, where you watch a show or a cinema?
Yeah. So I think that you can. I think they're doing a thing there where they'll have certain movies on. You can buy tickets to see it.
Yeah.
But a lot of the times they have like a movie channel on, or they have a film showing or whatever. So you go in and you see it's obviously like virtual cinema and stuff, but other people are around. But you can mute them. So I'm like, that's good. You can mute them. So it's like, perfect. This is all right. So when I last went in there, there was a guy sitting in the row in front, and then he starts throwing popcorn around. So that catches my eye. And I'm like, well, that's annoying. That's ruined this for me already. And then I'm thinking, who at big screen thought that was a good idea? Let's introduce popcorn into the mix. You can't fucking eat it. What's the point of it? So this guy's just lobbing popcorn everywhere. So then that's just annoying me. What was the point of popcorn?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
Well,
I feel like I've ranted a lot in this.
I feel like that's a really good idea, though, in terms of like, I mean, honestly, to be really honest, I would still prefer it just to come straight to Netflix. And I would happily pay the £10 just to watch it, like, a new release on Netflix. But if they won't do that and they're like, oh, okay, no, like, we won't do that because it complicates all the licensing deals, but we would license a new movie to VR, I would happily pay like £10 to like put on a headset and watch the latest like films that came out. Just like I would be very happy to like put on a headset and sit front row at the, you know, the theater, or like, I don't know. I do think like It's interesting, because it's like these legacy business models that are stopping this innovation happening, because too many people's like livelihood essentially and their incentives aren't, you know, they're not in line with it. It's a bit like, did you see AMC theaters in America have said that they're in a hissy fit about Universal, and they're like, is it Universal?
Yeah, yeah.
Universal. They're like, we're not doing films anymore.
I understand it, but I don't think for them to, because AMC owns Odeon, over here. So like, so now Odeon are not going to be, apparently not going to be showing them. And now Cineworld have jumped on the bandwagon as well. And now don't plan on showing any Universal films. But this is an age old thing anyway, because there was always, I think it was like 12 weeks. So there had to be a space of 12 weeks from theatrical release to home release. And that was to protect the cinemas and stuff, so they could earn enough money. Because bear in mind, cinemas only make about, I think it's something like 30% of the ticket sales, mm-hmm. or around that.
Yeah, so the money and the popcorn and the drink.
Yeah, 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 and that's why the prices of those is so extortionate.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I get it, but at the same time, I don't think it's beneficial to them in the long run, I get
why they would be pissy about it. But here's the thing. Your business is dying. Like, unless you become like what you was what did you call it? The Prince Charles, is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you become the kind of, like, unless you become a venue that is offering something bigger than just a film, like, of course the distributors are going to cut you out. Like, because they can make way more money. The amount of cost it must cost to, like, get digital packages and stuff, and like the amount of money that they would lose in those 12-week windows because they're not allowed to, like, put it online when all the hype is, like, around it. Like, of course they're going to move to digital eventually because they'll make more money that way. Like, if they're losing 30% to cinemas for the right to distribute through those venues when those venues aren't, you know, it's not like. When cinemas first came back, it was like the cinema was the leverage because people were coming to the cinema. So people would, you know, film companies would have to grovel probably to get their film shown because it was the only way to access the audience. Now it's the other way around. Like, cinema should be groveling, well, and they kind of are, like, to the film studios because ultimately they could cut them out and go straight to the consumer and make a shit ton more money doing it. Then it becomes about, like, well, if we're not emotional about this, if we don't get sentimental about it and just think about, like, the history of it and the, you know, all of that kind of stuff, realistically, cinemas have to reinvent to offer something more. And like, that sounds really cold-hearted, but from a business point of view, that's kind of the way I see it. And again, tying it back to VR, as much as I want this industry to succeed, I totally empathize with the end consumer. It's not ready yet. Like, if I was a consumer and had nothing to do with this industry, I wouldn't be buying a headset. I wouldn't be spending £400 on something that I could play probably a few apps on and watch a few things that were interesting to me. I wouldn't do it. And so I think that often people in business and in certain industries get very romantic about it and they get a bit bitter. And that's the thing that I find quite amusing, because business is unemotional. It's all driven by the market. The market decides, essentially.
But this kind of goes back to what we've spoken about before in the past and stuff, where, you know, that there are some people that kind of got into this early doors for the money.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, the love of making content, you know, within that medium, which is essentially is what is going to push it forward. It's people that are doing it for the love of it and not for the paycheck.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way you can do it, really, because there's, you know, especially now, there is no paycheck.
Exactly. At this level, you need people kind of creating the content, creating the stuff that will bring the consumer to it. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, so many thoughts. I feel like this has been a phenomenal episode. Naturally, we've gone totally off piece, but in a good way,
that's it's a given.
Also really relevant.
Yeah. And I got ranty. Got quite ranty.
I loved it. The fire was really heavy. It was enjoyable.
It was. Oh, I have to take the rest of the day to calm down now.
Yeah, I've riled you up, and now I'm very much looking forward to the day that I can go with you to the Prince Charles Theatre to watch The Room.
Oh my god, you have to. That's a thing.
Yeah.
You've got to. Because honestly, I think you'd like it. I think you'd really enjoy it.
Totally into it.
It's such good fun. And then I'll make sure we got plenty of spoons.
Spoons?
Yeah. I haven't seen a disaster artist yet, which is like horrific for me.
Right.
Being such a fan of the thing. But yeah, there's, you have to, we don't have to. But this is the nice thing about it. So if you turn up and you haven't got any spoons, mm-hmm. the people next to you, if they see that you don't have spoons, they'll share their spoons with you.
Why have you got spoons?
So the whole idea is that you take a load of plastic spoons with you, because in the film, because the film is predominantly just set in this one house.
Yeah.
But for some reason, in the background on the furniture, there's like framed photos of spoons. Right? Really yeah. random. So basically the idea is when you're watching the film, anytime you spot one of the photos of spoons, everyone shouts spoon, and then you start throwing the spoons around.
That's so random.
Yeah, it's really weird, but it's just, it's brilliant where you just like, there's all these plastic spoons just go everywhere.
That sounds,
you feel bad for the cleanup crew after that.
Terrible.
After
one of those screens, maybe we'll switch to wooden spoons.
Oh, no. Well, no, there used to be a time as well. There was a scene in the film where they, like a few of the characters go out into this like alley and start throwing American football around.
Yeah.
And years ago, when I first started going, that used to be a thing as well. People would bring an American football. Yeah. And then as that scene was just about to start, they'd go up to the front and then start throwing the ball around.
Mm-hmm.
But then they stopped allowing American footballs to be brought because of health and safety. Because, you know, health and safety ruins everything. Ruins everyone's fun. But it's brilliant because there's the same beats and stuff for the film that you know the specific things to shout out at certain points in the film on this and that. But each screening, there's always something new that someone brings to the table. So you know the set things that people are going to shout, but you don't know what other little like comedy gold people are going to throw out there as well.
I think what it's always different. Post-COVID, we should host anyone who wants to come with us to watch The Room in Prince Charles Fifth. I think we should do
there
that.
We are.
When social distancing lifts,
and then
allowed.
And drinks beforehand, because it's even better when you've had a couple of beers in you.
Ah! Okay, deal. Right,
I'm excited.
I'm going to go get some food because
cool beans.
I've done this podcast weirdly without having any breakfast, which was not the best idea in the world.
Wow.
I felt like it fueled a little bit more fire than usual.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it was so good to chat. And I feel like people listening, hopefully this was, I don't know,
hopefully it was something.
Yeah, maybe it was like a little bit positive, a little bit kind of realistic, a little bit rambling, a little bit just helping you through this lockdown period. So, yeah, you can find me on the socials at AlexMakesVR, and I'll make the series of interviews that we were talking about at the beginning available. I'm not sure when they're going to come out yet because I've got to do the task of editing them now. But yeah, probably in the next couple of weeks. So I will let everyone know on my socials when that's
cool beans. And yeah, let me know and I'll put the link in the notes for this episode as well.
Fabulous. Thank you. Sounds where can people find you, Dan?
At home these days. But if you're online, you can find me at Daniel K. Hatton. On all of the socials.
Excellente.
That I'm on. Yeah.
Until next time, my coronavirus digital socially distant friend. Cut. You forgive me.
I'd actually forgotten about it. Until you brought it up. I forgot that I was a cuck until you brought it up. Oh, well, that's a great way to end, isn't it?
It is great. See ya.
All right, stay safe.